We made this.
Welcome to the Starlight Ballroom. Hey!
Welcome to Shipwrecked and Comatose, the podcast about Red Dwarf on the We Made This podcast network. My name is Mark and I am your host for this third episode in a week. We're only doing five because we're doing episodes on the magazines. We're looking at volume 2, issue 3. And as always on this journey, I am joined by the two fools who agreed to do lots and lots of magazine episodes. Hello, Carl.
Ahoy.
Ahoy.
Permission to come aboard the ship of fools.
Oh, I see. Hello, Colin.
All right.
I'm as all right as I can be when I'm doing another fucking smegazine. I've had enough of these.
Being a grumpy bastard.
How are you two feeling about it?
This is a good one, I think. I think there's some really good stuff in here.
Your idea. It was your idea.
Right, and no, it was my idea. But it's just that, like, you watch a 30-minute episode and make a few notes. Ace. This took me hours to read. Volume 2 is bigger than Volume 1.
It is in depth.
8 more smeggy pages.
It is, but we have a lot more quality, I think, in this volume than we did have in the previous volume.
Yeah.
It's almost a shame that it's coming to an end because they really seem to have hit their stride. When there's an actual series in production, they're actually really quite good and thorough, but when there's nothing there, there's a lot of thumb twiddling and page filling to be done.
And recipes.
Recipes. You see, I liked the recipes.
Yeah.
Those are the good old days. But I wonder why it ended when it did. You would have thought it would have had a few more months after Series 6 hit. I wonder when we get there if they'll actually say why.
I've not read the last one yet.
Yeah, and I think it'll be interesting to find out. But we're not there yet. We are on Volume 2, Issue 3, and we're doing 5 this week, so we have hit hump day. So on the cover, we have got Little Jimmy Osmond Strikes Again. What? In fact, what does that actually refer to?
The long-haired lover from Liverpool, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, but what article?
Mimas Crossing. The Osmond family appear in Mimas Crossing, the comic strip that we'll get to in a bit.
Really? Is that all it is? That's bollocks. Right, okay.
Yeah.
they've got an on-set report from Series 6, a Danny John Jewell interview, Crichton's on the front, with a How to Make a Mech article, as he is, that's what he's advertising. And we are told that we have the return of Mr. Flibble. So when you saw this cover, what were you most excited about?
For me, I think it was the bit at the very top of the thing saying, on the set of Series 6. Just like, oh, excellent. Well, you know, we're going to be seeing Series 6 and what's going on. And whenever they've gone sort of backstage on these things before, they've always been pretty good. So for that, it was for me, it was that being able to see what's going on Series 6 and sort of all the teasers they've come up with is finally coming to fruition.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, particularly if I was reading it at the time, that would absolutely be the bit that piqued my interest the most because this was gearing up. It was like about a month and a half away, I think, maybe 2 months from when the actual Series 6 was broadcast, I think. What neither of you have mentioned so far, you've both said, oh yeah, it's got on the set of Red Dwarf 6. You haven't mentioned the absolutely fantastic pun, Get Down Shepperton, which is precedes it because it's filmed at Shepperton Studios. That is a very good pun. I liked it.
Next up is the Smegatorial. Clever, it's a pun. I said that last week, moving on. So there's lots of hype for Series 6, which is in 12 weeks. And he mentions that Tongue Tide is going to be released. And there is a picture of Peter Ragg reading the Smegazine.
That is a lovely picture. I like that.
It is.
In it.
Yeah.
Because of Where Are the other day, we've just started Series 10 in our sort of main timeline. And that's the last series for Peter Ragg. So seeing a picture of him looking all happy and reading the Smegazine is quite nice.
I think. It's lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a legend.
Yeah, absolutely.
It does feel like the front cover and the Smegatorial have kind of replaced the contents page, and I've already mentioned I like a contents page. We are repeating ourselves a little bit on these, you know.
Yes, you are.
you are? Okay, fine. Next up is Lister the God, which is the first of I want to say four comic strips. Mm-hmm. And did anyone else feel a little bit cheated by the resolution about how Crichton survived?
It was interesting because it was very 1930s serial ending. It's like you've got the cliffhanger in last month where Hudson turns up, and then within seconds you find out that, no, that was Crichton.
Yeah, yeah, it does have that same bat time, same bat channel kind of feel to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
What I did think was interesting was the elaboration on Rimmer as part of the Prophecies of the Cat Bible. That was cool. I thought that was really interesting. And it kind of made sense with Holly's decision to bring back Rimmer as well.
Mm. Yes.
I mean, a lot of these strips, I mean, this strip, I think, it could have been an episode. I get the feeling that some ideas here were the writers from this magazine trying to pitch to Doug, like, you know, I'm available in the next series if
you fall out with Rob.
Yeah,
because at that point they hadn't.
No. I've heard Seven's going to have a bigger budget and stuff like that, and you want more set pieces. May I direct you towards this comic strip here that I've written?
I mean, it hasn't happened yet, but stranger things have happened when it comes to Doctor Who.
True.
A lot of the big Finnish serials became TV stuff, and some of the new adventure books as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. And for what was a very bleak story, the ending was particularly fucking bleak.
I was quite impressed by that, because you expect everything to wrap up nicely. And what happens is, it's made no difference whatsoever, and the holy wars are continuing.
Even worse, Lister just walks away.
Yeah.
And refuses to help.
Yeah, well, Grim. I mean, there's the thing of, obviously they've gone, we're going to get wibbly wobbly here. There's the thing of, they went back in time, and there's nothing they can do about it because it's already happened. You forget what I mean.
Yeah. Mm. Fixed point in time and all that.
Yeah, so it could be a fixed point in time. I mean, Lister could have done something, but when you do meet the cats, I mean, it's the Red Dwarf tradition about not mocking religion, but at least prodding religion a great bit, and they're very stoic in the no, the war has to happen on all this. And the thing I thought was interesting is how there's the faction of one of them, of half of them think that he's called Cloister, and the other half think he's called Clister, showing that they've advanced past the whole blue hat, red hat, or green hat, blue hat thing that it was. So it's warped over the years, and it's even gotten worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was bleak, actually, now I've said it out loud.
Yeah. It's still great, but it is bleak as fuck.
Yeah.
Next up is news from The Dwarf, and there's information on the release of Tongue Tied as a single, and that the books and magazines are doing well with sales. Mm-hmm. 10%ers is getting a series. Meh. Red Dwarf 1 is coming to video, apparently.
We've got names for the volumes, guys. We've got names for the volumes.
Finally due on July the 5th.
Yeah. I wonder whether that actually happened. We will find out eventually, won't we?
I think there's a further update in next issue that we'll find out tomorrow.
Magnificent. And then there are a couple of things that I wanted to highlight from this. I'd forgotten that Go Getters was a thing. That's going on the specials list.
We have got it.
Excellent. I had also completely forgotten that Go Getters was a thing. So I found that there's one episode that I found straight away on YouTube and watched the other night.
Brilliant.
It's basically Taskmaster's dad.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's groups of celebrities being given tasks to do. It is Taskmaster's dad. The episode that I found was from the previous series from 1991. So you'd got, unfortunately, it was presented by Dave Lee Travis, DLT, the hairy sex offender. And then you'd got the three teams, Craig Charles, Linda Hartley, who was Kerry Bishop on Neighbours, and Andy Crane.
Wow.
Andy Crane.
Then you've got Janice Long, Michaela Strachan, and Keith Chegwin. And then Bruno Brooks, Sonia, and Liz Brexit Kershaw.
Wow.
definitely a time capsule of 1991, or possibly even 1988.
Yeah, this as well. I think I did do it. We did do a search, and we found it's on the list of videos we've got. Is the episode and a half? I think I found another one somewhere as well. This happened just before he gets arrested.
So right.
The first series goes, from what I understand, the first series goes out, he gets arrested, and then the second series goes out a lot later than intended.
After he'd been acquitted.
Yeah, and it was kind of like, right, let's put it out on like a Sunday afternoon or something like that. Where, or, you know,
that's a shame.
One in the morning, yeah, in the Meridian region or something like that. But yeah, Andy Crane. And Sonia's still kicking it. She was at Eurovision.
Sonia.
Love Sonia.
Yeah.
The only other thing on this page that I wanted to highlight was there was an auction of some Red Dwarf and Doctor Who stuff, and one of them was a Vervoid, and they were the plant monsters that looked like they had a bell end for a face.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know what that was.
It's a Vervoid. It's from Trial of the Time Lord.
Yes, I'm not familiar enough with old Doctor Who, so I put a picture of it up on our podcast network Discord, and unsurprisingly, Baz from the TARDIS Crew podcast replied within about 30 seconds going, that's a Vervoid, that is.
Former guest, Baz,
yeah,
who did poetry when we did... But we did fucking poetry on this podcast. We are so highbrow.
Bring on the porn. This brought back a thing for me is, where I work, we hold an annual Doctor Who convention called Whoverville.
Yes.
And this, as of time of recording, it was last weekend, and we were doing the close down, and we couldn't get Sylvester McCoy to stop talking. So it went over by about half an hour. So we had to try and get everything back to set for what was happening afterwards, which is usually cinema screenings. And at one point, everything was done, but there was a table full of replica heads, just like you see in the picture here on the Smegazine. And I had to actually radio, like, can somebody please come and remove the Cybermen heads from the cinema, please? Because it was just like this row of Cybermen just in front of me. It's like, these are really expensive. I'm not touching them. So if somebody could get them. It's like, otherwise they're going to be front row of a screening of Barbie. So
good.
In the Mojo Dojo Casa House.
I've still not seen Barbie.
It's a great film, Mark. You'll like it. You'll really like it. Surprisingly got a very serious message in it, but handled in an incredibly well way.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to go because I thought it would be misogynistic. Turns out that it's
not
feminist and subversive. Yeah. And I am feminist and subversive.
It's brilliant.
Anyway. Next up is an advert, which is advertising magazines by the same publishing company, 2000 AD, Judge Dredd and Batman. Later on in the issue, there is an advert for Sega Power, which pleased me. I mean, I was a Nintendo kid, but it was still cool to see Sega as a thing.
Yeah, I read Sega Power.
I've been reading, not Sega Power, but I've been reading Mean Machine Sega over the last few days as well, because another bit of We Made This Podcast Network news, Jeff, who's on some of the Star Trek podcasts, is starting up a new podcast called 8-Bit Back Issues very soon. In fact, by the time this goes out, it may already have had the first episode out if I've recorded it with him, because I'm the guest on the first episode.
Nice.
I've blagged a spot for Nintendo Magazine System.
Awesome.
Total Nintendo and Your Sinclair.
Brilliant.
So I'm looking forward to being on that as well.
Yeah.
I wonder if I can get on, because I remember Sega Power eventually turned into a magazine called Mega.
Yes.
And it was much more glossy, and if you looked at it, it looked like an SFX or something like that. They tried to make it a bit, for lack of a better term, sexier, but it was still a one about the Mega Drive. I used to have all of those, and it had comic strips in it, probably drawn by the same artist that did the Smegazine, actually. They were very, very similar. Captain Ages.
Awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is a cool podcast coming your way soon. Next up is the Chris Barry interview part 2. And I learnt that being oiled by women wasn't very nice because there was sawdust in the oil.
I mean, it's all about the environment as to whether it's going to be pleasurable. I mean, yeah, you don't go somewhere that's sawdust and wood chippings, but, you know, Chris Barry might be up for that kind of thing.
So don't go to one of them, like, really old-fashioned pubs and do it in there. With, like, yeah, sawdust on the floor and stuff.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into a nearby chippy's yard with a couple of ladies in steel bikinis going, right, here, put my hands up, go on, rub it in. Yeah.
There were a couple of bits that I picked up in that interview that I wasn't aware of. I didn't know that Hollow Ship overran originally by about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I think we talked about it on the episode. Loads,
so apparently I did know that and I've forgotten it then. But I'd forgotten that bit, so I relearned that. The line, I've come to know you as people I've met, Chris Barry claims he came up with that line, although he says that Grant and Naylor may dispute that.
Yeah. He's in a very introspective mood here, isn't he? He's talking about whether the role gets to him a bit. He said, I suppose it does a bit, but cut to like a couple of years later, like, I've had enough. Completely had enough.
It does feel like this was him kind of working towards his I only want to be part-time in Series 7, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which is actually kind of sad, but also kind of fascinating. Mm.
And he didn't like Backwards. Backwards is a great episode.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's interesting this because from the way it's talked about and from the rate we've been doing stuff on the podcast ourselves, it becomes very apparent that Chris Barry was working flat out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Britus did, what, 10 series in all?
Something like that.
Pretty much straight away. And obviously Red Dwarf is, as we've seen from many of the documentaries and stuff, it never seems to be a cool, calm and easy experience for everybody making it.
No.
So I think he was completely worn out by this point. And obviously he must be doing as many voiceover jobs as he probably can as well.
Yeah.
I always think it's quite interesting that Chris Barry doesn't sort of surface much these days to do much, unless it's Red Dwarf. I get the feeling that he's made his money.
Yeah.
And he's done it through voiceover work.
And he's sitting around with his classic cars.
Yeah.
In a big garage.
Yeah.
Probably got a payday from Lara Croft as well. Decent one.
Yeah. That's the thing is as well, I can imagine, like, he must still do voiceovers. He does the convention circuit. There's certain people now, like two that spring up to me is most of the cast of Supernatural are constantly doing conventions and things like that all over the world.
Right.
Cause you can just find them on YouTube and you're like, when do they stop? And they go on tour. They've started hosting it themselves and gone on tour around the country with it. You almost get a feeling like, you know, if Red Dwarf could almost do that. It's just like, wheel them out, sort of, you know, go on tour and do it.
Yeah.
So he must be, that must keep him busy. Hattie Heyridge as well, I get the feeling she can do that until the cows come home.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned there was some conversation about Britus. There was quite a lot of Britus in there, which, you know, is interesting. Yeah. But I was like, I would like to know more Red Dwarfy stuff, and that did feel a bit, not filler, but not what I wanted to read. Yeah.
I think there's a couple of bits in this issue where it does feel like they could ask more, but they're pacing themselves. I don't think they realise that they'd only got, you know, was it 5 issues left after this? And obviously they're hoping that they're going to be going for years and years and years. So if they ask everything in the first or second interview, then what are they going to talk about later on? It's a limited subject.
It's interesting, I find that Chris is talking about all of the characters have got a nasty streak in them, and he'd love to actually go proper evil with Rimmer.
He's right.
Yeah.
Actually.
Oh, he is right.
Some of the dark stuff that Lister gets up to.
Yeah.
We have looked at that in the past.
I mean, we saw it in the cartoon in this issue as well.
Yeah, exactly that.
So, yeah.
But yeah, overall, I thought it was a really interesting interview, really, really nicely written, and the quality has improved since we started reading this. Hmm. I definitely think you're right about that. Next up is Androids and the Wizard of Oz comparison thing, man.
Break out the dipstick, chamois leather, and Bongella, Mark.
I quite liked "He ain't heavy, he's my brothel." Yeah. That was a good pun too.
I was going to say that that is the redeeming feature of this particular Android strip, is that there is a brothel called "He ain't heavy, he's my brothel."
This isn't the worst Androids that we've had. I still don't like it. Next up is Balance of Power, which is one of the episode guides. When they don't really have titles, it's kind of an episode guide. But yeah, it covers some interesting stuff, like they wanted Red Dwarf's interior to look like a submarine.
Yeah.
And the set ended up being what they describe as two BBC sci-fi.
Yes.
Which I thought was, whilst cruel, not inaccurate.
Yes.
I mean, when they said, they brought it on themselves almost. We go, submarine. Boy, did the set design people run with it with the word submarine. I liked this. We're building towards the first series getting released on video. So this is quite an interesting thing. We thinking about it in the mindset of it happening then.
Yes.
These are things have not been seen in many, many years. So hear them talking about the behind the scenes on it before it comes out is really good. Looking through today's eyes, a lot of it is like what we've heard 1,000 times before out of Doug and the others of Grey. So much grey. I do think it was quite interesting seeing that they really wanted to stop him smoking very early on.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't.
No.
But they didn't because Craig Charles smoked a hell of a lot. And that's what they say in there. They were trying to, but with the fact that Lister, the character, smoked, it gave Craig Charles the excuse to smoke on set all of the time. So he ran with that and did.
Yeah. Oh, 80s. Oh, the 80s.
The fact they also talk about this episode being their first sitcom-y episode for Balance of Power and how it's like the odd couple in space. I agree.
Yes. In that
I remember watching Series 1 again and Balance of Power did feel different because we had Future Echoes before this and, of course, the end where we had to establish the world. And then, but Balance of Power really did feel like, right, we've had a minute to calm down after everybody's dead, Dave, and all that. What are we going to do now? Oh, get on each other's nerves in space.
Yeah. How did I do, Mr. Lister, sir?
Yes, exactly.
When it eventually got released, it was the first video that I had. I didn't have part two of series one. So I just repeatedly used to watch the first three episodes. So, Balance of Power is one that I watched absolutely fucking loads.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is one that there are very few sort of sci-fi elements in it. The only sort of things in there are the fact that the sort of end goal of switching the hologram out from Rimmer to Kachansky. That's the only science fiction in the entire thing. Everything else would have worked in Porridge or something like that.
True. The only other thing that I think that's really interesting about this is that not only did some of the fans question whether or not this episode works, the writers did too.
Yeah.
I mean, you would, wouldn't you? This is their big break. They're doing something that's not been done in the, I'm guessing, a long time. I think it's Paul Jackson was like, don't do a sci-fi sitcom because nobody does sci-fi sitcoms.
Yeah.
And so now I can imagine during the filming of it, they must have been doubting everything they did in terms of, is this funny?
Second and third guessing everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I don't think they ever get fully comfortable until like series three.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which we may well be talking about later on in this episode.
Yes. Yeah. I did like that. There were a couple of things I also found interesting in this, but they'd originally planned to do a lot more flashbacks to what life was like on the ship before everybody died off.
Which you can actually see,
yeah.
I think. You can see that that was clearly the intention, and then it kind of, like, disappeared as they went along.
And then the designing and printing the cans of leopard lager took up a third of the graphics budget for the entire series.
Yeah. Wasn't worth it, was it?
Well, I mean, it's an iconic thing. Leopard lager is, it's like Morley's cigarettes, isn't it? You know, on The X-Files and billions of other shows. I'd like to see Leopard Lager turning up in loads of other series, so it's like a shared universe.
What's the series where it's coffin nail cigarettes? Oh.
I know that one, but I can't think of it.
I don't.
Oh, it's the Kevin Smith
universe.
I was
going to say, yeah, that's... Yeah.
Okay,
they're called nails, sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Next up is the Junior Encyclopedia of Space, and hooray for pedantry of fans. I mean, yeah. Hooray, I love that so much.
Well...
But there was some interesting stuff here. There was a question about the models, which was answered really interestingly. And there was also, what are fans of Red Dwarf called? And I would have preferred Dwarfers, but apparently we are Smeggies.
Well, this is it. Somebody says, what are Red Dwarf fans? What's the collective noun for a group of Red Dwarf fans? The ones that are suggested in it are Dwarfies, Dwarvians, Smegheads, Scutters, or Smeggies. And it doesn't say Dwarfers anywhere.
No. And I'm sure that's the one that's pretty much...
Dwarfers is, yeah. And I'm absolutely sure that the phrase Dwarfers is used in one of the issues of this magazine already. So it existed.
I mean, I've never heard us referred to as Smeggies.
No.
Although I get it, it's quite clever, and it's like, lol, they use the naughty word throughout the show. But
It's when they said, oh, it's approved by Rob and Doug themselves, you get the feeling they were walking past and somebody shouted, guys, is Smeggies okay? What? Yeah. And they just kept on walking. But yeah, Dwarfers. I mean, they refer to themselves as a Dwarfer in the series as well, don't
exactly.
they? When they try and get... I can't remember who it is, they try and get on board, but they go, you could join us as a Dwarfer. And it's like, yeah, I'm a Dwarfer. I think it's Series 6 as well that comes out.
Yeah.
So.
There was also something that I really, really liked that I thought was actually genuinely interesting. This is the first time there's been stuff I've engaged with at all in the Junior Encyclopedia of Space.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Series 4 was broadcast differently on the repeat.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you did. I'm sure did that I? Got mentioned in the episodes. Yeah, because it was the meltdown wasn't shown because of the Gulf War. So they moved that.
Well, yeah, but I didn't realise the repeat, they switched it back.
Yeah, they've put it back to where it should have been every time it's been broadcast. But the videos...
The videos and on the iPlayer and on anywhere else are the original broadcast series.
Ah, I didn't know the iPlayer had got it in that order as well.
Mm.
Fair enough.
Mm. So there you go. Next up is the Grant Naylor-Gate tapes, and this wasn't very funny. It was filler, and I've got nothing to say.
Yeah, somebody cancelled their advert last minute, didn't they?
So, yeah, it's a fictional transcript of Rob Grant and Doug Naylor coming up with the idea for Red Dwarf. I like the bit where they were talking about Red Dwarf, because that's really stupid pun, and I like really stupid puns.
I like really stupid funny puns.
I thought Red Dwarf was all right.
Next up is another comic strip called Mr. Flibble Goes Asset Stripping, and my notes literally read, what the actual fuckery.
It's great.
I love the artwork again.
Yeah,
of course.
Basically, if you don't know, Mr. Flibble, it's he goes and visits the Cookie Cola Bear trademark world. And it's a very thin Disney allegory, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
And then he basically turns up and kills everybody.
Yeah. I mean, I felt traumatized after reading two pages of a comic strip. Yeah.
He just turns up, kills everyone at the Cookie Cola Bear trademark world, and then eventually Cookie Cola Bear themselves, and brings about... Flibble Co.
Yes.
And then it ends on a blowjob gag.
I thought you were going to say a blowjob goat then.
Yeah.
Which it definitely doesn't end on that. That would probably get them in trouble.
Yeah.
Next up is Get Down Shepperton. Yay! Holy shit, the spoilers. Mm. Holy shit, the spoilers.
Yeah.
They even at one point say, oh, we don't want to do spoilers after doing fuck tons of spoilers.
However... It's great. I loved this article.
I didn't say it wasn't great. Yeah. I just said it was spoilerific.
Yeah. I like the fact that the warm-up for this was a juggler.
Yes.
No.
Eels, the band, had a juggler, a deliberately bad juggler, as their support act on tour one year.
Yeah.
Who just Brilliant. Used to come out on stage and be shit.
Brilliant.
Then everyone would get pissed off and then the band would come on.
Amazing. Now, Have you ever been to a live studio audience no. for anything?
Yes.
I have as well. And so I've been to see the Wordle quiz that's hosted by RuPaul. It's not called Wordle because they can't call it Wordle.
Yeah.
RuPaul's Word Race?
Basically. And I also went a few years ago to Strictly Come Dancing. And that over allocation thing is something that still happens now. And I remember they do huge amounts of tickets and you really do have to get there stupid early. Mm. And it's fascinating that they didn't know that, even though they were working in the press.
Yeah.
This was a long time ago. This was late 90s. As part of a college thing, we all got sent down to, well, it wouldn't be Central Studios probably anymore, but the Nottingham-based studio where we were the audience for Sarah Green's Carlton Cooking Channel's cooking chat show thing.
That sounds awful.
They did about 3 episodes of it and we all had to move around a bit and look...
Like you're a different audience.
And we all looked over at each other to people who we didn't come in with going, college trip, right? Yeah. Media students. Awesome. Yeah.
Brilliant.
But yeah, they did that for, one of the very few like round the clock channels at the time. So yeah, they must have been like, just wheel them in.
Yeah.
And get them to change outfit or whatever. I think we did have to change outfit at one point. And we did the thing of,
nice.
You know how on some of these shows, like the credits roll over the crowd?
Yeah.
We all got up way too fast at the end. So we got told to basically sit down and continue like, and for the credits to go over the top.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. The closest thing I've done to that is I've been at Latitude Festival. I've been to a couple of like Radio 4 comedy program tapings, like the Now Show. And I've also been to a Andrew O'Neill's History of Heavy Metal stand-up show taping. I'm in the crowd on the DVD on that a couple of times. Mm-hmm.
But there's so much in this fucking article.
It is, yeah.
It's really, really in-depth, yet gently feels kind of ragtag because they didn't know about the over-allocation thing. And verbatim, they quote something that I remember vividly from the Smeggle.
Yes, that's the bit that I got really excited about.
Yeah.
Rather than the fact that they were there watching sirens being filmed, that's exciting enough, but they were there when a smeg-up happened. They were there when the, I've just cacked my pants. Get it right, Rob, there's a bag of chips in it for you. That smeg-up, they were there when that happened. That's history, that is.
Well, I think they were there for more than that particular one, but that's the one that they documented.
I got really excited about that.
Me too. And fascinating, it does seem like they differentiated Robert and Craig from Danny and Chris.
Yes, they're the sensible ones.
As the two sillies and the two sensible ones, yeah.
Yeah.
And you kind of see that in the Smegups as well.
Yes, definitely.
Kurt would love this article.
Yes, but he won't listen to this because I don't think... Actually, does he listen to these? Kurt, are you listening to this? Maybe. You two are shit.
X-Files was overrated.
We'll find out. There we go. Yeah, that bit I just absolutely loved. I really, really like this entire article. There's also a bit about Craig Charles in between takes singing the Stereo MCs, which very firmly puts it in 1993.
Yes, it does, yeah. There's one last thing where they're talking about how... Robert Llewellyn rips off the top of his nose and he has to shoot a thing for comic relief. And the thing, the easiest thing you could think of is, well, give me a red nose and I'll put it on over the top.
Yeah.
But they don't have one. I recently watched the making of Series 10 after we watched it together the other day. And it does show a clip of him, once he knows he's finished, ripping off his mask. And the first thing he does is he takes his nose off.
Right.
Despite his face.
Yeah, so you get the feeling that this is a thing for him, is when he can take it off, he will just take his nose off first, I'm guessing, to breathe. But this might be early on in the day where they're like, Robert, make sure you've completely finished, will you, before you rip your nose off.
Quite. Next up is Cat's Chorus, which is about the imminent release of Tongue Tied. Mm. And he never released his own song.
I was a bit sad reading it because he's so hopeful that he's going to have a really successful music career. And obviously that didn't happen.
This also brings up a thing that we mentioned in our chat that we have, which is he's danced for Wham.
Yes, I was not aware of that at all. He's in the Edge of Heaven video.
Yes.
He gets pulled up to dance with them on stage. In 1985, he was one of their dancers on tour.
Yeah.
Which is how he'd ended up being in the video as well. I'd also completely forgotten that Rob Grant and Doug Naylor had written the Chicken song for Spitting Image.
Oh, I remember that. I did remember that. What was interesting was they were talking about the B-sides, and I owned this on CD. They were wrong.
Yes.
There was no rock metal version of the Red Dwarf theme tune, and I don't think that's ever existed.
No. This was all... He was planning to do this before he went into the studio, and he ended up doing... It was two or three different remixes, wasn't it, the B-sides were?
Tabby Ranks.
Yes.
There is a version of him singing the Red Dwarf theme song, but I wouldn't call it a particularly zapped-up heavy rock version.
No.
It certainly didn't make it onto the CD single, that's for sure, because I had it.
I know there is a version because I've heard it. But yeah, I think it's on the vinyl. It's on a different version. I think it's quite interesting where he talks about how the only thing he knows how to do is entertain. He's a singer, a dancer, an actor. It's like, yeah, he is, isn't he? He's a proper all-rounder.
Yeah.
And that's why I remember when he got signed up for Strictly that year, I was like, well, it's in the bag.
Bit of a ringer, wasn't he?
Yeah.
That doesn't seem fair.
Yeah.
I mean, before anything, before an actor, he was a professional dancer before anything.
I don't think they ever met. I know I didn't watch his Strictly run, but I'm pretty sure they never mentioned it. Because if they'd have said on TV, like, he was a former dancer that danced with Wham all the way across America, like, okay. Maybe that was the thing of, if he's crap, then it makes him look really bad.
And here's Bill Bailey.
Yeah.
Who isn't.
I did watch the videos of Bill Bailey when he did it, and it's so delightful. He blatantly did it, say this is a bit off topic, but he blatantly did it for the lark, and he's a man just enjoying himself.
Yeah.
Next up is Holograms, and Lettuce Page, etc. But is it normal thing, as much as it's a worthy charity, is it the normal thing to write to a letter section of a national magazine and ask for a plug of your charity?
It's a bit odd, but I get the feeling that it might have been a slow week for them.
It's incredibly tenuous, isn't it? It's the Save the Whales charity, and they've got a whale called Holly.
Yeah.
And that's why they wrote to the Red Dwarfs magazine. Obviously, someone working for the charity is a Red Dwarf fan, otherwise it wouldn't be on their radar at all. It's a worthy charity. I'm fine with it being mentioned.
Yeah, I think it's better than a smug fucker talking bollocks, isn't it?
What I am not fine with is Eric Davis.
Yeah.
Eric Davis and his Eric W. Davis from Chorley. If you're listening, Eric, fuck you. Overall, I've just finished reading the new issue, Volume 2, Number 1. Overall, I like it, but you could cut down on the comic strip pages. Fuck off! Yeah. The comics are brilliant!
They're the best bits! Yeah, what a bell end.
Yeah.
There's also the picture that someone sent in of their 2.5-month-year-old son, Samuel Ace Warman, and it just meant Ace Warman. What an action hero name that is.
Yes, it is.
Warman!
There were two pictures of babies reading the... Smegazine.
You say reading, the 2.5-year-old looks trapped.
They've just put it on top of him, haven't they? Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a look on his face of, mother, let me out of this thing, please.
It's kind of like beauty pageants where they're being forced to do something about their parents.
Red Dwarf pageant.
I want the youngest Smeggy. Yeah. I want the youngest Smeggy. That is a callback.
I definitely, for my own amusement, used to take various photos of before Elodie was old enough to read and before Stanley, my nephew, was old enough to read, with them sitting there holding things like American Psycho or
War and Peace.
Killer Crabs. It was nearly always a horror.
Oh, yeah.
Have you got a copy of Killer Crabs? I've never read
I've
that.
Got the first 4 or 5 books. Guy N. Smith is fucking ace. Right. He is the Garth.
We'll talk about books very shortly. But before that, next up is Mima's Crossing Part 1. And it's that art style again
that I fucking love. David Littleton.
Yes. And it's kind of like a further exploration of the body swapping concept from Red Dwarf.
Yes.
And it also brings in a drug called Bliss, which is absolutely fucking frightening as a concept. Really deep, nasty sci-fi shit. Yeah. And this was so, so good. Like, this may be my favourite comic strip they've ever done.
Well, it's very, very heavily tied to the books.
Yes.
Because obviously yes. Bliss, I mean, the bit that it says at the start about Bliss, you know, you could get addicted by even looking at it and stuff like that. Yeah. Is word for word taken from Infinity Welcomes Careful Drivers.
Yeah.
And yeah. You've also got Trixie Labouche is in Better Than Life, who's the character
I've
in this.
I've forgotten that.
Yeah, so she's the body that Rimmer ends up in because his own body has been stolen when he breaks out of prison.
Yeah, it is interesting because we do get a Rimmer cameo in this.
We do.
And it almost feels like that parallel dimension thing of if she doesn't tell him to clear off, what could have, it could have been, it almost feels like this is breaks off from that Better Than Life continuity because she gets sucked into this story instead of the Better Than Life story.
Yes.
Or this is what leads to the Better Than Life story. I can't remember, but.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I read that. And obviously we are going to look at those books eventually. I've not actually reread them since we started the podcast. Maybe I should.
Yes. They still hold up. They're still brilliant.
Yeah.
Mm. Next up is Red, R-E-D. Read any good books lately? It's a pun.
I like the way
it's
you,
their
you
book
could
review
just
section.
Record that and just put it in each episode because you say it the same way each time.
They review an Asimov, Jurassic Park, a book I'd never heard of that sounds magnificent called Star Smashers of the Galaxy Rangers. And a book that I must own, but alas, I think I'm going to struggle to find Wiener Dog Art.
Wiener Dog Art.
Wiener Dog Art. You
know. Especially with your safe search turned off.
I did try and find Wiener Dog Art on Amazon. It is not something on British Amazon, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's the far side, isn't it? It's Gary Larson. Yeah. I noticed Star Smashers of the Galaxy Rangers as well, and how it looks very much like the, almost like the Discworld books on its cover.
Mm. Mark, there's loads of them on eBay for about £2.40.
Ooh, I'm a treat myself. Yep.
I thought they would be.
Mm. I mean, I don't have much to say. I think their reviews were fair. Mm-hmm. Their analysis of Jurassic Park actually being a fantastic book is right.
Jurassic Park was really interesting because this is a review of the book before the movie was out.
Yeah.
And it says something in there about we expect the movie to be really good.
Yeah.
And at that point, they didn't know that it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Also, they're pleasantly surprised the book hasn't got now a major motion picture splattered all over the front cover.
That eventually happened because that's the copy of Jurassic Park that I purchased as a child.
I mean, that logo, the Jurassic Park logo, is iconic. It's one of the best logos in fiction there's been for a very long time.
Yeah, yeah. Just one of the best logos, full stop.
Yeah. We had it on because it was, I think it's its 30th anniversary last month. We've had it on at work, and it still sold loads. It was like, as soon as we put like Jurassic Park's on for its anniversary, like a lot of cinemas at the moment, because we've got the strikes going on, which has stopped a lot of movies coming out until next year. So what you're going to see at time of recording is you're going to see a lot of like, right, what's got an anniversary coming up and getting re-released. Right. Like since the strike started, we've had Jurassic Park, Serpico, Enter the Dragon. We've had a lot of the Disney stuff getting re-released because it's 100 years of Disney.
There's a Disney film every week. I'm going to see, at the time of recording, I'm going to see The Jungle Book on Sunday in the cinema where I saw it for the first time, which was the first cinema I ever went to.
You are taking Elodie, right?
I am taking Elodie,
Stay at home, Elodie. I've got to go watch this.
Coincidentally, it ended up, even though I didn't live anywhere near here, ended up living less than a mile away from the cinema that I first went to when I first went to the cinema when I was 4.
I think at this point I'm going to say it is early September and this is being released in November. So we recorded this a couple of months ago by the time you get to listen to this. Next up is the Great Red Dwarf Debate, which is a fascinating concept of having two of their regular writers, like, debating in two parallel articles whether the first two series of Red Dwarf is the best Red Dwarf, or whether the subsequents, three series at the time, series 3 to 5, is the best Red Dwarf.
Yeah.
And as a concept, I think it's fantastic. I struggled with it because it felt kind of painful to hear genuine fans absolutely tearing episodes that I love a new arsehole. And because they got that knowledge, it was good and accurate. And I love the concept, but I came out of it a little bit sad.
It is interesting to read because you can't tell if Steve Lyons, in making his case for early Red Dwarf, is right, I need to build a compelling case because this is a debate. Or, right, now I can finally say what I feel.
Yeah. I think there's definitely a bit of that in there.
Yeah.
Definitely, I'm with Jonah Zarrow, who's with the series 3 to 5 are better than series 1 and 2. I still love series 1 and 2.
Mm.
First 6 series, and as we've discovered recently, 10's bloody good as well.
Yeah.
I know, right?
The case for 3 onwards is the thing. This is where it's hit its stride because, like we mentioned earlier in this episode, Rob and Doug feel comfortable and, you know, the actors start to feel more comfortable. And it shows, I think, from series 3 onwards, like when stuff like the polymorph and things like that, we wouldn't get things, performances like Lister humping his underpants and all that. We wouldn't get that in series 1 because everybody was too slightly uptight about it.
Plus, we've got Crichton.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think the strongest argument across both of it isn't really touched on as heavily as I would have done if I'd written one of these. It isn't true Red Dwarf until you've got Crichton in my head.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's considered a controversial opinion amongst fans, but I found myself disagreeing with the criticism of series 3 to 5. Yep. And I am on the 3 to 5 side, but I also grossly disagreed with everything that they said about series 1 and 2. Everything about this article was interesting, intelligent. It was well written. It was an innovative concept. It was well researched, and I hated it.
Right. It's like watching your parents fight, isn't it?
Yeah.
I see what you mean. I think there's more to agree with on a factual basis in the case for 3 onwards. Because it is bringing up things like the cast have said they're not massive fans of it. The writers have said they're not massive fans of it. The bits where they mentioned, it was like, oh, you know, people who like the first 2 series say, oh, the cat was funny when they only had 2 lines an episode. Well, that's not great for a start.
Yeah.
You know, more cats.
I mean, it's accurate, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. But also, I get the feeling that if they hadn't swapped from Norman to Hattie Heyridge, part of me thinks Hollywood have gone earlier.
Yeah.
Because they'd have run out. Having Hattie Heyridge refresh the role.
Definitely agree.
Admittedly, it only lasted another 3 series, and she didn't get a great lot to do, but I think it probably would have happened a lot earlier if it had still been Norman.
Yeah.
And I suspect Norman would have shit the bed and got fired.
Yeah.
It does make me laugh that out of all of them, the one who's probably the biggest, for lack of a better term, shit disturber out of all of them is Norman Lovett. Even Craig Charles in his wilder, younger days didn't ruffle feathers like Norman Lovett did.
No. Next up is a short one-page article called Creating Crichton's Head, and it's about Peter Ragg and how Crichton basically nearly didn't happen because they had massive problems with creating the mask for David Ross. And they really got there by the skin of their teeth.
Yeah.
And apparently David Ross was pleasant. I think that's the most shocking thing in the whole issue.
Yes.
I think this goes back to who it was that said he's not a nice person, which is Norman Lovett.
But he didn't come across very nice in the interview that we had in an earlier magazine.
No.
True.
He seemed very, very arrogant.
Yeah, I think he came across worse than Norman Lovett.
Oh, God, by a long way.
In a more positive note, I love hearing them talk about the development of the mask.
This was great.
If you ever see I found all the making ofs, somebody put them all up on YouTube, so I don't have to keep filtering through all the discs on my DVD shelf. Listening to Robert Llewellyn talk about series 3 and the development of the of the mask or the helmet as he thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
And then seeing in previous series, like, the evolution of what they made it out of and how much quicker they could do it. And right up to, again, I watched the making of Series 10 the other day and the special effects people talking about how much easier it was to make the mask, and they actually motion captured him, basically, to make the they fired a load of lasers at him to get all the contours of his face so they could make it better. And Robert Llewellyn was saying that how in the every series beforehand, if he wanted to make Crichton smile, he practically had to rip his own cheeks off, smiling as hard as he could, just to make Crichton Wry smile. And with the Season 10 mask, if he smiled, Crichton smiled. It was very much more intuitive to his face.
That's definitely an improvement, then.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, and next up is almost like a spiritual sequel to this article.
It's a companion like a piece, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's called How to Make a Mechanoid. And this is the perspective of the makeup artist. Yeah. And what a bloody brilliant article this is as well.
Yeah. Bethan Jones, who is the makeup designer on Series 2 and 3.
Mm. And it talks about her baptism of fire, not knowing what the show was about, coming in and basically it felt like they were talking gobbledygook. And I thought that was incredibly charming.
Yeah.
Because she wouldn't have had the internet to even have a quick Google search about what she was going into.
Yep.
And so she just sat there and went, shwer?
Yeah.
They were talking about Red Dwarf?
Yeah, well, she was brought in unexpectedly because she was part of BBC Wales. Red Dwarf was being made in Manchester. They'd got two makeup artists that they usually work with in Manchester, and they were both busy on other projects, so couldn't do it. So the BBC had to keep everything in-house because of the way it's funded, and called her over from Wales.
Yeah.
So that's why she hadn't got any sort of previous expectations of what it would be.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you got called over for a show you didn't know from Wales, that's a train journey.
Yeah.
You'd have Googled it, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
It's just a snapshot of 90s life, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this article's great. There's a lot of talk about hair, though, and I got quite envious.
I've got hair on the bottom half of my face.
Yeah, same.
I mean, I've got some hair, just not on my head.
I'm just sort of talking about how long the mask took to do, and the fact that one of the issues was they couldn't have it. Well, they couldn't get it to look flesh-toned initially, and it was yellow.
And she had to put makeup all over it with the right set tone to make it look flesh-coloured,
It's fascinating, because just like we said from the sound of it, we've all been asked to do something. We're like, do you know what you're doing? Yep, totally. I know what I'm doing. And she's kind of done that a bit, thinking, oh, I'll get it when we get there. And she's got there, and it's like, bloody hell. I've got to make a what? You know, but because she was coming from, like, World War One things, so she could do, like, blood and gore and detritus and all that kind of stuff. But this is completely different. It took a long time for me as a kid to realise that Craig Charles's dreads weren't his dreads, they were extensions. It was slightly disappointing.
And the cat had a longer ponytail because of Bethan Jones.
Yeah. Yes.
Because she felt that that would improve the look, and that's fantastic. Yeah. I didn't know that. The other thing I didn't know was that they taped a turtleneck to Norman so that they could get the transition for him on the screen, which, I mean, if it works, if it works.
Yeah, it did the job.
She came up with a hologrammatic H as well. I'm very impressed that she mentions that it is literally just double-sided tape and it stays on all day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, that's impressive, and kind of a credit to Chris Barry, because if I had something stuck to my head with double-sided tape all day, I don't know if you could get me to act that well, because I'd be like, I've got a thing stuck to my head with tape. Yeah.
And the only other thing that I thought was fascinating was just the acknowledgement that if you put a bit of weight on because you've stopped smoking, you need a new mask if your name's Robert Llewellyn, which is actually really sad.
Yeah.
That he quit smoking and he fucked up the mask.
Yeah, it's a very good article.
Isn't it?
The fact she mentions little things that we would have taken for granted, like in Stasis Leak, she made the android bellboys with the silver heads and stuff, you know, something that just walks past in like 2 seconds of a shot, and you're like, oh yeah, somebody did have to build that, and it was probably a friggin' nightmare in 1988 to actually build.
It's a really nice insight to an aspect that I really haven't put much thought into how it would work at all before.
Particularly on this magazine episodes, actually, we've absolutely kind of idolised Peter Ragg. But how important was Beth and Jones?
Very much.
Amazing article.
She says a very fun thing is after David Ross, they obviously have to redesign the makeup for Robert Llewellyn. And she said, I wouldn't have been surprised if they had to recast Robert every series after that first one.
Yeah.
Because of what they had to do to him. It's also a credit to Robert Llewellyn that it's like, he guts it out wearing that mask. And he does to this day. It's, fascinating.
Next up is Next Month in the Smeg, which is the preview of next month's issue, or in our case, tomorrow's issue.
Yep.
And there is some fantastic art advertising an article on the many faces of Lister. There's also a mention of a Hattie interview, the regular features, an article on Danny John Jewel's single, another article on Keith Mays, the sound effects guy, which after the Beth and Jones, I'm very excited about. And then they're launching something called Cred Dwarf, and there's going to be comic strips.
I don't remember Cred Dwarf, showing you how the Red Dwarf game should be played. I don't remember this at all, so I'm quite looking forward to that.
We'll find out tomorrow.
Yeah.
Which one are you most excited about?
I'm quite looking forward to Hattie Heyridge, to be fair.
I think it's Keith Mays for me, because of...
Yeah.
I've got a book written by Ben Burtt, who was the sound engineer on Star Wars.
Hmm.
You know those books where you used to get the buttons where you press them and they make the sound effects at the side?
Yeah.
For little kids.
Oh, brilliant.
But it's like a really posh version of that because you select the number and it'll play you a sound effect. And then it tells you how they made that particular sound effect. Like the, you know, the blaster noise was hitting a big metal cable and stuff like that.
Mm.
And that's fascinating. So I'm expecting that kind of level of awesomeness from Keith Mays.
Mm. Yeah, actually, I'm quite looking forward to this. This one, that. Keith Mays. I'm on the TikToks, like the young people. But it is interesting seeing some people on there. Like, there is a Foley artist who records her sessions and shows you how she makes stuff.
How
what she does to create certain sounds. And it's really good. And that's the thing. It's not all, you know, people dancing and all that. There are actually some really interesting things on there. And this one of this lady just doing the Foley work is, you know, standing in a box of gravel and you know, crunchy crunch crunch. All that is really, really good.
Brilliant. I went into the wrong job. Customer fucking service. I'd love to do stuff like that.
I know, right. Next up is Dwayne Debley part 4, Court. And there's two panels and one of them is a full page spread. I was surprised how short this was. But it's still cool.
Because it's so short, it is 9 pictures.
Yeah.
There are just 9 different panels in this on the spread across the 2 pages. There's not enough for it even to grab your attention. I'm quite enjoying this particular strip.
Yeah.
It's got, you know, brilliant Nigel Kitching artwork, but I wish they hadn't split it so thinly.
Yeah.
And it's like I was saying earlier about them saving stuff for other issues. I'd much rather that they had 6 pages of this, maybe, and then, you know, other things later on.
Or maybe 3 pages and get rid of androids.
Still more than that. I want,
It is lovely art style, though. Like, the baddie in this strip is so well designed. It's like the character looks like what would end up being a bit like Spider Jerusalem from Transmetropolitan, sort of Hunter S. Thompson looking character, but British, which is always fun when, especially when you hear a character in like one of these strips, which you always mentally have in your head would be American, just because of how Marvel DC. But when they go, oh, bugger, it's like yes, you know.
Next up is the final article, News from the Omnizone. And this is basically a report on other sci-fi going on. So Star Trek is continuing and Next Gen is going into its final series. And Deep Space Nine is going into its second series. And everybody seems to love the Borg. There's news on British telly and video releases. I don't remember the Borrowers TV series
at all. I do. That's the only bit on this page that I give a shit about, because I don't care about Star Trek. Never watched Quantum Leap. I loved the Borrowers. It was ace.
Is it relatively easy to source, or is it one of those shows I'll never find?
Don't know. I watched it at the time.
I think it is out there somewhere. I'd say I did watch Quantum Leap quite a bit. The thing that I didn't actually realise was it was cancelled. I thought they ended it on their own steam, but yeah, it was actually cancelled, and they were all signed up to do another one.
There's also a bit in here mentioning that it's the 30th anniversary of Doctor Who.
Oh, don't get me started on the 30th anniversary of Doctor Who. There were supposed to be loads of big things, and what they did was they put a pretty new logo on the video releases. Fuck the 30th anniversary of Doctor Who.
But then it's the 60th anniversary this year.
Yeah. And they've gone back to a new logo, to that logo. I do like that logo. It's a good logo.
The best thing about the 30th anniversary of Doctor Who was they released the entirety of The Trial of a Time Lord in one box set that was a metal fucking TARDIS, and I loved that. That was my favourite video I ever owned.
Weirdly enough, I'll send this to you afterwards. The other day, the two of the regenerations are a bit odd. One was the Patrick Trout into John Pertwee, and the big one being Colin Baker into Sylvester McCoy.
Well, it wasn't Colin Baker.
No, I know.
He didn't go back for the...
But somebody online on, I can't remember what the channel's called, has made them. So they've made a Colin Baker to Sylvester McCoy transformation, a regeneration scene, and it's excellent.
You sent it me and it's brilliant.
Yeah. And he did one for Trout and Pertwee as well. And it's like using old footage and CG, and they're really good.
Now, that would have been good for the 30th anniversary, fuckers.
For the Colin Baker one, they used the audio from Big Finish.
Of course they did. That makes sense.
Which I thought was genius of a genius idea, was use what is actually canon for it. It's going to be interesting to see if the 60th anniversary does go ahead, because a lot of their writers are the British wing of the SAG-AFTRA Guild.
Oh, no.
So, yeah.
Well, we support the strikes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, if we don't get Red Dwarf, if we don't get Doctor Who, then maybe people should get paid fairly.
Yes, that is absolutely true. And hopefully we get it a bit later when they have come to their senses, paid them properly, and then they're back to making stuff.
Yep.
In it. And finally on the back page is a pin-up, and it's Kat and Lister looking like they're about to kiss.
Craig Charles looks really cute on this, I thought, with his little gerbil cheeks. Series 4 is when everybody looks probably the healthiest.
Am I wrong, though? It really does look like they're about to kiss.
Oh, they're making gooey eyes at each other. Yeah.
Yeah, man. And that is the pornography I would have liked to have seen. So that is the end of issue 3 of volume 2. Carl, what was your favourite and least favourite article in the whole thing?
My favourite bit would have been the making a mechanoid. Mm-hmm. My least favourite, I sometimes when we do this try and not mention like some of the regular bits that are in every issue because they are consistently poo. But I think I'm going to have to go with the Junior Encyclopedia of Space. It means very little at this point. Yeah.
It is a regularly hated on article by but us, isn't
it? The only reason I say that is because this is a very strong issue.
Yeah.
And I don't want to pick any of the new things for this issue because they were all good.
Yeah, that's fair.
Colin, what about you?
Least favourite is how short the Dwayne Dibley excerpt was, because I'm not even going to call it a fucking comic strip. Because it's
claws are out.
It's not fucking long enough. It's...
You're right.
When it's all put together, it'll be great and I'll read it all in one go. My favourite was Get Down Shepperton. For not only the fantastic pun headline, but also it was a brilliant article. And they got to watch a Smeg Up live. That's history. That's like being at the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
Wow. Yeah.
Were you there when he nearly cacked his pants?
For me, it was the Great Nailergate tapes. Just diabolically unfunny.
I forgot about that. Yeah, that's my least favourite bit as well.
Okay, good. Good. I'm glad we agree. And I think with an honourable mention to the kind of dual article of how to make a mechanoid and creating Crichton's head, they were fascinating. Yeah. They were superb. That was definitely the best article. But I think it just pipped it. Mima's Crossing was so good. What an incredibly vicious comic strip it was.
Yeah, looking forward to reading more of that, definitely.
Mm. Yeah. But that's the thing. We all three of us had very different choices for what our favourite thing was in this issue. And that speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yep.
Right. Quickly, what is your favourite board game, Carl?
Cluedo.
Good choice. What's your favourite board game, Colin?
That is tough, because I fucking love board games.
Me too. I'm
very much liking Horrified at the moment, which is where you like various old Universal monsters. So you've got like Dracula and Bride of Frankenstein and the Wolfman, and you've basically you've got to do various different defeaty things to kill them. And it's great, because you can play it one player if there's no one else around, or you can play it, you know, up to five players. It's great.
I do want to expand on that. I love Cluedo, and I mentioned this to Mark the other day. If you're a fan of things like that, do check out Murdle, Murdle.
I've seen that.
I have had a go. I can't do that daily. There's too much commitment.
It's become part of my routine now, is I will go into bed, and then about 10 past midnight, I'll do the Murdle. It's I think the actual term for it is it's an Einstein puzzle, but you solve a murder every day. Amazing. And using a cross grid of and clues and everything, and it's so much fun.
I like to think I balance that out because I commit a murder every day.
True.
Nice. So, like Colin, I bloody love board games. I have a ridiculously large board game collection. I've just bought the remake of Hero Quest. I'm absolutely delighted with it.
I forgot they redid that.
Yeah, but it's not my favourite board game. I just can't not pick Shadows over Camelot. I think it's the game I've played the most. I love board games where it's cooperative against the game itself. And Shadows over Camelot is Arthurian, and I love the legends of Arthur and Merlin. And it was just the perfect game for me. It combined everything I liked. Even the expansion isn't too complicated and dead easy to incorporate into it. Shadows over Camelot, if you like cooperative board games, it's the best
one. I have not played that, but that sounds very good.
So thank you for listening to another episode of Shipwrecked and Comatose. And until tomorrow,
right, spread out some wood chippings and get out the oil.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast, was created and produced by Mark Adams and Kurt North. You can find us on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod, and we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network.
Do you like music, and do you like podcasts? Chances are you like music podcasts. Take this one, for example, Pick a Disc. I'm Matt Latham, and every fortnight a guest comes on to Pick a Disc to talk about an album for any reason that they want to. We'll talk about the album as a whole, we talk about the songs, we talk about any personal stories about the album, any if they've ever seen the band live, and all sorts of other crazy tangents. And if at any point any of that made you want to listen to Pick a Disc, then you can find us on your podcast apps of choice or on the Facebooks and Twitters and Instagram under Pick a Disc. We're also on the We Made This Podcast Network on We Made This Network. com and on Twitter at we_made_this. Goodbye.